All right, Wednesday, 5 p.m., a hot one. Got a hot show for you today. Time for American Hit Radio, 90.3 WHPC, WHPC HD. I'm Tom Ryan with my lovely wife and co-host, Heidi Morales Ryan, on the board, and sometimes the microphone.
Aloof, but in the house.
See what I'm talking about? And what we do on Wednesdays, we've been doing it for a while. In fact, this is a long time coming, actually. I think we've been doing this for about 11 or 12 years now, running our way through a list of 1,000 record albums. I don't mean vinyl albums specifically. I mean collections of songs that you would call an album in whatever format you care to listen to it as. But for the first 30 years or so, they certainly were always record albums. And they've begun to fall out of favor as of late because of all the digital stuff and all this, the different services that provide you with music. And I know you use them. Don't deny it. But the thing is, the problem is like you rely on them. And by doing such, you're allowing them to tell you what to like. And I like to keep my own opinions to myself with stuff like that. Thank you very much. And that's why we are doing what we're doing. Counting our way through what I would consider to be the 1,000 of the best albums ever released. And I broke them up into two categories to balance it out. 500 of them are top 40 albums. The other 500 are not top 40 albums, just to be sure that I wasn't going to get all hung up on favoritism and that sort of thing. And we started in the year 19, with albums that were recorded in the year 1955, and we are working our way up to the present. We are now, in chronological order, we are up to April of 1977, and on the not popular 500, which is to say the alternative top 40, we're up to number 229 out of 500. Not quite at the halfway point with that, although we're well past it on the top 40 on the other side. All that being said, this is a very, very, I'd say, a time-changing album, an era-changing album. It was totally missed in New York. New York, it was totally missed in the United States, excuse me. I mean, I'm thinking of it just in terms of my own, you know, what happened in my life. The band is The Clash, and it's their debut album. And none of us, almost none of us, knew who The Clash were until 1978 when CBS saw fit to release their second album here in the United States. They didn't even release this album in America, if you could imagine that. So if you need proof that punk rock was thoroughly disenfranchised in America in 1977, you need to look no further than this album. The Clash might as well have been invisible to the American music establishment. Released in England in April of 1977, this album didn't see daylight in the United States until July of 1979. Over 2 years they waited to let this album get released in America. So I am placing this song chronologically for the British release because that's correct. It would be weird if I was going to put it in 1979. It would be out of sync. So anyway, as a result, the British release probably did more for the European market than any other album in history, as it became the best-selling import album of all time. Eventually, America got smart, including people like me. But in defense of the American music industry, it already had its hands full before the onset of punk. American rock aficionados were still debating country rock versus progressive rock, while also actively debating the validity of disco. Longtime fans could barely tolerate yet another trend to confound them. Punk rock garnered attention in 1977, and most listeners treated it like an unwanted bastard child. European press saw dollars in the shock value, but American press acted as though it sensed a disease and dismissed all punked acts as out of hand. America saw punk, the English variety in particular, as something dangerous, something that needed to be contained like nuclear waste. The Sex Pistols' disastrous tour of North America only added fuel to the fire, making it almost acceptable to enact violence on anyone who adopted punk's fashion sense. I happened to see this with my own eyes when a group of Garden City jocks at a bar in Garden City in 1978 attacked a table of spike-haired teenagers who had walked in to the bar in 1978. I actually watched a guy punch a girl in the face and make her bleed just because she had spiky hair. It was that unbelievable, if you could imagine like this, that sort of stupidity happening. But in 1978, it did, right here in this town. Well, it turns out that America's initial assumptions about punk rock, though, were quite incorrect. Under the gruff exterior, there was a political underbelly that challenged the status quo at every turn. Punk rockers despised complacency. And one band in particular proved to be quite eloquent, about their sense of purpose. The Clash drew inspiration from the Sex Pistols and the American groups, but their rebelliousness was not about anarchy. It was about establishing an identity and enacting street-level politics. Someone called them the only band that matters, and the phrase stuck, because in 1977, it wasn't just hyperbole. The Clash were full of youthful energy, combined with a political purpose that made other punk bands look juvenile by comparison. As a member of a pub rock band called the 101ers, Joe Strummer was part of the English pub rock scene that preceded punk, while Mick Jones, the guitar player and singer for the band, other singer, was trying to piece together his own post-pub outfit. On different occasions, they each saw the Sex Pistols and were inspired by the possibilities presented by gaining ground-level entry into a ferocious movement that did away with the implied hierarchy of established music trends. Love songs and fantasy-laced poetry were off-limits. Strummer and Jones set to writing songs about issues that they faced and the reality that surrounded them. White Riot, one of their first singles, succinctly confronted racism and police brutality in less than 2 minutes, while Janie Jones, another hit in England, attacks class structure and youthful indifference. Perhaps most notorious, though, was a song that they wrote called I'm So Bored with the USA, a direct hit aimed at the way that America's superficial culture permeated almost every aspect of British life. There were songs that attacked the record industry, one called Remote Control, and then there were singles like Complete Control that attacked their label for capitalizing on songs that attacked the label. They were that clever. This was no ordinary youth rebellion, but rather a series of public service announcements with very loud guitars. By the time CBS got around to releasing the album in America, The Clash was a well-known entity. The label culled off 4 of the original songs, then added 5 that were previously available only as import singles. The change messed up the original flow and continuity, but it's hard to argue when the new songs included White Man and Hammersmith Palais and Complete Control. But 2 of the most important punk anthems ever written, but we're not going to play them today because they weren't on the original British album. We might get around to it somehow anyway. The British album was perfect, but the belated American version somehow improved on that perfection. In either version, and you should probably own both, I mean that, The Clash stands as testament not only to the validity of punk rock, but also to the revalidation of genuine roots rock rebellion. So, let's start with that song about basically talking about the laziness of youth and how they should be doing something besides complaining about their lives. This is called Janie Jones. Rock and roll, whoa. The love is getting strong, whoa. The love is Janie Jones, whoa. We don't like it, burn your mouth. The love is rock and roll, whoa. The love is getting strong, whoa. The love is Janie Jones, whoa. We don't like it, burn your mouth. And he knows what he got to do. He knows he's gotta have fun with you. The lucky lady. I think this was all recorded in February of 1977, and America was like so behind in terms of picking up on this stuff. I guess it was because we really weren't ready to hear this sort of like politicization of punk rock here in America at all. It didn't seem to make sense. We were like too busy, like I said, like, you know, making fun of like the punk as being like, I don't know, like safety pins through your ear and things like that. Everybody was just thinking that that's what punk was all about. And the Clash were like light years away from that sort of a thing. They were intelligent. But at this point in time, they really didn't even have a full band when this album came out. Joe Strummer and Mick Jones, both playing guitar and vocals, certainly with Joe Strummer singing most of the songs, even though, you know, his mouth just sings like this a lot. I know, but he's pretty amazing at what he does, and you can hear the intelligence in it. But Paul Simonon was the bass guitarist, didn't sing on this album, although he eventually would. But at the time, they had a temporary drummer named Terry Chimes. And on the album, they changed his name to Tory Crimes, a bit of a pun and a dig at English establishment there, until Topper Hedden came along and became their permanent drummer, and he would remain so until the band broke up. But the songs themselves just basically reek of what culture was like in 1977. It could bring you back there, if you missed it, it still can give you a really good idea of what it felt like to be singing about politics and real life in 1977 without having to worry about thinking about whether or not the band was going to be selling millions of copies or anything like most labels would. In England, they did great. But in America, Columbia just said, you know what? This is not commercial. It's not good for the radio. We're not going to let it play over here. So what ended up happening? They imported over 100,000 copies in the first year, and that made it the best-selling import album of all time, until they eventually did release it in America. All right, here's the next track. This is actually sung by the other guy, the lead guitarist, Mick Jones. It's called Remote Control.
Here we go.
a robot. I obey.
I'm a Dalek. He's a Doctor Who fan.
Is that what that is?
As he says, before he says I'm a robot, he says I'm a Dalek.
There's so much about it. Yeah, and I always had trouble here understanding some of the words myself. Yeah, it took like decades for it to begin to really sink in on a lot of these songs. This next one was controversial for some people. I don't see why. I think that it's a very, you know, it's a very important point. If you write a song called I'm So Bored with the USA, because you're living in England and you feel as though like America has taken over your culture in just about every shape and form. So they really do a great job of a huge and the energy, just everything about it is just, I think it's brilliant. Let's just hear it. I'm so bored with the USA. You got to recognize that this is not a band that's trying to be outrageous just for the sake of being outrageous. Like, you know, they were making very significant sort of points that nobody else was doing at this point. I mean, nobody was doing things like this. When they say Yankee Dollar talks to the dictators of the world, in fact, it's giving orders and they can't afford to miss a word. That's good. And then he goes on to talk about Yankee detectives are always on the TV because killers in America work 7 days a week. It's clever stuff. And it doesn't get old. It's 49 years now since this album came out. That's incredible. Here's a song that actually took that Joe Strummer and Mick Jones wrote when there was a street riot, a race riot, actually, with the skinheads basically getting involved with, you know, basically throwing bricks and whatnot at the blacks, and then the blacks throwing bricks back, and the whole thing turning into a total mess. And again, it's basically talking about whether or not people are basically intelligent enough to think for themselves rather than just following what everybody else does. Like, you might hear the words, it's like all the power is in the hands of the people rich enough to buy it. Well, we walk the street too chicken to even try it. Here's White Riot. What's taking over? Oi. Or are you taking orders? It was just a great way to basically make, especially like if you felt like you were outside of society, you could imagine like a lot of the punk teens.
Disenfranchised.
Yeah, felt very disenfranchised. They were very, most of the punk, you know, kids were poor kids.
Well, unemployment was very high.
Yeah.
And the economy was stagnating in England, so there was a lot of rife. And I guess that was Margaret Thatcher, right, coming in?
I think it might have been a little bit before her.
Okay.
But close. For me, it wasn't so much about
poll taxes and all kinds of things that were happening, very high tax rates.
Yeah. And the thing is, like, the music that was around at this time, like I said, you know, whether it was going to be the classic rock was not cutting it for this generation. It just wasn't working anymore. It just seemed like it was getting old and pompous. And this brought it all back down to their scale, to reality. But there wasn't anybody who was actually in the music business that was speaking the truth to the kids as well as the Clash were. And that's what made this album so important. The critics went berserk. I'll read some of their reviews about it later on. But let's keep going. We'll play two tracks back to back here. Side one, on its own, has got 8 tracks, but they're all relatively short, you know, for that, you know, basically for what it's worth. But we'll play Hate and War first, and we'll segue that into What's My Name?
Hey,
You're listening to WHPC, WHPC HD, Garden City, New York. The show, of course, is American Hit Radio. I'm Tom Ryan with Heidi Morales. Ryan, we do this endlessly on Wednesdays and loving every second of it, especially when we get... I mean, I could almost say that when I started this whole program 10 years ago or 11 or 12, whenever, it's been a long time. It's been more than a decade for us to get to this point. I was probably thinking of this album as being a really prime spot for, you know, this is something I would really want to cover more than almost anything. I would, as far as albums that I consider to be important in my life, this would have to be in, you know, my top 20, my top 10 probably even, because it just changed my life around. I was at a point here in America where punk didn't really mean much to us at all, and all of a sudden I'm beginning to think like, wow, this is what is going to change music. This works. Anyway, let's keep going, because we've got a couple more songs on side one even left to go. First track up is Deny. It's one of those songs that was on the British version only. It was not on the American version. It was deleted. And we'll segue that into London's Burning.
Turn it on your face and the religion. Everybody's sitting around watching a better way to spend the night than speeding around underneath the yellow light. This block, this one leads to that. Going down through the empty block, looking for a home. I'm a movie if this don't, cause I'm all alone.
It's all there, all the stuff that was like the frustrating youth about the boredom of, like, you know.
So they're bored with the USA, but they're also
bored with the,
bored
with their
in
own
London
culture
too. Yes, right.
And the fact that there's no jobs. And this next song is exactly says exactly that. It's called Career Opportunities.
Opportunities are one that never knocks. Every job they offer used to keep you at the dock. Career opportunities are one that never knocks. I hate the army and I hate the RAF. I don't wanna go fighting in the tropical heat. I hate the civil service boom. I won't open that bomb for you. Career opportunities are one that never knocks. Every job they offer used to keep you at the dock. Career opportunity, the one that never knocks. Opportunity, the one that never knocks. Every job they offer used to kick you out the door. Career opportunity, the one that never knocks. Career, 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 and I never
knock. All right. Now, I mentioned there's a couple of songs on the album that were like culled off of the British album, which are really kind of rare in America. That just never really got played very often. Except for the people who did manage to obtain the original British version of the album. The American album is actually in some ways better because they added some really great songs to it. But these are two songs back to back that were removed from the album. The first is called Cheat, and the second is called Protex Blue.
I'm drugged up on excitement. Don't get none, I go wow. I don't know what can be done about it. It's to play the game. You get nothing out of it. Find out for yourself. Driving a goody goody. You better cheat, cheat. No reason to play fair. Cheat, cheat. Or don't get anywhere. Cheat, cheat. If you can't win.
what happened when the band put the album together, they realized that it was running kind of short time-wise. So they figured that they could do a cover of something. And one thing that the punk culture in Britain had a lot in common with was the reggae culture. There was a tremendous like mingling between punks and Rastas in England. And it kind of worked out really, really nicely in a musical sense. So the Clash decided, who were big fans of Junior Mervyn, who had an album out that was called Police and Thieves. And he sings it just like this. You know, Junior Mervyn's version, it's impossible. But when Joe Strummer does it, it takes it to a completely different place. By far the longest song on the album. It almost hits six, it does hit 6 minutes, in fact. Here's Police and Thieves. It's like almost like a, almost tension relief with that song, although it's still intense. Police and Thieves, cover of a Junior Mervin track. There's one more track that they put that came off of the American version, and we'll play that real quick right now before we come back to say goodbye. It's a track called 48 Hours.
Friday or Saturday, what does that mean? Some place of time and needs a heavy scene. Monday's coming like a jail on wheels. 48 hours, you 48. The places I've been. 48 hours in 48 48 hours in 48 48 hours in 48 48 hours. I come to sound from top to bottom, trying to get around but my legs are broken. Every time I miss it, cause I ain't got a ticket. 48 hours in 48. 48 hours in 48. 48 hours in 48. Fails. The 48 fails. She fails. And they got fails. Chicken for kids. 48 hours in 48. 48 hours in 48.
All right. Now, this is, as I mentioned, the UK version of the album as it was first released in 1977, because the American version wasn't released until over 2 years later, which is ridiculous that that happened. But that's the truth. That's what did go down. In the Village Voice, though, this is a quote. The UK version of The Clash is the greatest rock and roll album ever manufactured anywhere. From the Village Voice. At the year end, the decade end list for the newspaper, they ranked the UK version as the best album of the 70s. That's amazing. Meanwhile, though, there was one wise guy in England named Charles Shar Murray who went to see the Sex Pistols at a show, and The Clash were part of that show. And when he saw The Clash, he was not impressed. So he wrote this. The Clash are the kind of garage band who should be returned to the garage immediately, preferably with the engine running. So, I guess George, that's a George, I guess that Joe Strummer basically figured that he could like write a song about that. And he did, and that's the song that closes this album. He says, we're from Garage Land. Garage Land. Boots. Someone just asked me if the groove.